May I say that all too often men are betrayed by the word freedom? In variety theaters, I have often watched, before my turn came on, a couple of acrobats performing on trapezes high up in the roof. They swung themselves, they rocked to and fro, they sprang into the air, they floated into each other's arms. And that, too, is human freedom, I thought. Self-controlled movement.
Welcome to The Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. This week, we'll be reading Report to an Academy by Franz Kafka. This season of The Stories Jews Tell is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman.
Hello again. Our story today is Franz Kafka's A Report to an Academy, Ein Bericht für eine Akademie, which we will be reading in the translation by Willa and Edwin Muir. Kafka wrote the story in 1917 for Der Jude, a German Zionist monthly edited by Martin Buber, so this story was clearly intended for Jews to read. By now, when we say Kafka, we expect the unsettling worldview that we associate with the word Kafkaesque, but those first readers had no idea what to expect other than something associated with Jewish national solidarity. So imagine their surprise when they saw that this report was being delivered by an ape. Our story takes the form of an address to a distinguished audience and begins with the traditional salutation. Honored members of the Academy, you have done me the honor of inviting me to give your Academy an account of the life I formerly led as an ape. I regret that I cannot comply with your request to the extent that you desire. It is now nearly 5 years since I was an ape, a short time of span, perhaps, according to the calendar, but an infinitely long time to gallop through at full speed as I have done. Now, talking animals are not entirely new to literature, as we know from the story of Balaam in the Book of Numbers. But this ape speaks about his origins as a member of the species and delivers his lecture in exquisitely formed sentences, as one might expect, for example, of Charles Darwin addressing the British Royal Society. Actually, the ape tells us that he was supposed to speak about his origins, but explains that, regrettably, he can no longer do so. Why not? Because in the process of civilizing himself, he left his former self behind. He says, "I could never have achieved what I have done had I been stubbornly set on clinging to my origins, to the remembrances of my youth. In fact, to give up being stubborn was the supreme commandment I laid upon myself. Free ape that I was, I submitted myself to that yoke. In revenge, however, my memory of the past has closed the door against me more and more. I could have returned at first, had human beings allowed it, through an archway as wide as the span of heaven over the earth. But as I spurred myself on in my forced career, the opening narrowed and shrank behind me. I felt more comfortable in the world of men and fitted it better. The strong wind that blew after me out of my past began to slacken. Today, it is only a gentle puff of air that plays around my heels, and that opening in the distance through which it comes and through which I once came myself has grown so small that even if my strength and my willpower suffice to get me back to it, I should have to scrape the very skin from my body to crawl through." He explains how hard it was for him to effect this transformation, and that once it was done, there was no return, and also no primal memory. What this once free creature has had to surrender in the process of becoming human can never be recovered. If in the past he lived in a space as wide as the span between heaven and earth, he has squeezed himself into human form so successfully that the world of unchecked liberty is no longer an option. He now talks as one of us, and is one of the most eloquent among us, so that the more he talks, the harder it is to remember that he was once an ape. To put it plainly, your life as apes, gentlemen, insofar as something of that kind lies behind you, cannot be farther removed from you than mine is from me. And yet, everyone on earth feels a tickling at the heels, the small chimpanzee and the great Achilles alike. Our ape is very witty. He describes his evolution like coming through a birth canal, which can't be navigated in reverse. And the Greek myth about Achilles is that since his mother held him by the heel when he was dipped into the river Styx so as to attain immortality, his heel remained his only vulnerability. So just as the great Achilles never did become immortal, we listeners are equally vulnerable to a process that was as imperfect as that of Achilles and of his, the ape's, own evolution. The ape's tone is mournful. His loss is palpable. He accepts that those who framed the theory of evolution believe that they have advanced civilization, but he does not share their confidence about its rewards. So, unable to recall his life in the jungle, our speaker makes up for it by describing in detail his capture and what happened to him since. He was caught on the African Gold Coast by Hagenbeck hunting expedition. Hagenbeck, being a zoo in Hamburg, Germany, famed for its display of animals that were actually brought back from the wild. This is one of several contemporary details lost to us that would have made Kafka's readers laugh with recognition. The hunters wounded him twice. One red scar on the cheek got him the name Red Peter. The other below the hip left him with a limp and a raunchy reputation that he resents, after all. When he is asked to pull down his pants as an ape to show people his scar, they see nothing but well-groomed fur. Whereas, if his visitors were to do it, that would be indecent. So they should keep their smutty thoughts to themselves. The ape goes into harrowing detail about how he was tamed. He describes that his cage, with iron bars pressing against his back, forced him to squat continuously because it allowed him neither to stand nor to sit. Apparently, the human beings who put him through this misery felt entitled to do so. He says, such a method of confining wild beasts is supposed to have its advantages during the first days of captivity. And out of my own experiences, I cannot deny that from the human point of view, this is really the case. As someone now able to see things from both sides of the cage, our speaker grants human beings their point of view, but this report lets us see it from his viewpoint. He gives an unsparing description of the cruelty, the torment of pain, and most of all, the realization that there was no way out. Until then, he had always found a way out of situations. Here, I had no way out, but I had to devise one, for without it, I could not live. To satisfy his captors, he realized that he must let himself be tamed by becoming so much like them that they would be prepared to keep him on display rather than in that cage. The speaker must therefore learn to behave like his captors. I had to stop being an ape. He tells us that he came to that conclusion through a fine, clear train of thought, which I must have constructed with my belly, since apes think with their bellies. Making fun of how we imagine him, he flatters us as the condition of his being alive, which means that he has to assure us that he thinks only with his stomach. Yet, being actually quite a good thinker, he naturally comes around to the question of free will. Did he have it or not? Yes, but though he had free will, he had to use it to will himself into obedience, and he therefore warns us against the term freedom. Freedom is what human beings say they value, and yet how funny it is that their idea of freedom often translates into an idea of being in the wild. May I say that all too often men are betrayed by the word freedom. In variety theaters, I have often watched, before my turn came on, a couple of acrobats performing on trapezes high up in the roof. They swung themselves, they rocked to and fro, they sprang into the air, they floated into each other's arms. And that, too, is human freedom, I thought. Self-controlled movement. What a mockery of Mother Nature! Were the apes to see such a spectacle? No theater walls could stand the shock of their laughter. He finds it hilarious that people should imitate the very thing they have insisted that the ape give up. What some people call freedom is a return to nature in the form of apedom. We might remember this perspective the next time we see Cirque du Soleil or encounter philosophy's preoccupation with the subject of freedom. The ape's report on evolution reminds us that acrobats swinging from the bars can never hope to do it as effortlessly as monkeys in the trees. Nevertheless, the captured animal realizes why he felt he had to satisfy his captors. No one promised me that if I became like them, the bars of my cage would be taken away. He also admits that these men in themselves had no great attraction for me, yet imitate them he did, as the lesser of the evils facing him, since this was the only way he could hope to be, if not freed, then at least released from his cage. He found the process very easy. I learned to spit in the very first days. We used to spit in each other's faces. The only difference was that I licked my face clean afterwards, and they did not. For the reader, it is great fun to see the ape carefully learning to pick up all these great indicators of civilization. The speaker's description of how his keeper taught him to drink a bottle of schnapps is one of the high points of the comedy. And if it hadn't already become clear to his Jewish readers, this would surely have been where they realized that they were being given a parody of their own process of social and cultural assimilation. Learning to drink, Gentile style, was always part of the Jews' acculturation. Max Brod, Kafka's close friend and literary executor, tells us that when Kafka read them his stories, he and his friends roared with laughter. This passage must have made them split their sides. One evening, the trainer who instructs the ape on drinking a bottle of schnapps achieves a remarkable breakthrough. After downing a bottle, the ape calls out, "Hallo!" breaking into human speech. And though his human voice doesn't come back again for months, this triumph has decided his fate. Now that he has learned to speak, he is ready to be put on display, either in the zoological garden or on the variety stage. The zoo would mean another cage, anything but that. So the ape chooses the stage and embarks on a very strenuous education. Ah, one learns when one has to. One learns when one needs a way out. One learns at all costs. One stands over oneself with a whip. One flays oneself at the slightest opposition. My ape nature fled out of me. He achieves such success that his first teacher goes mad and has to give up teaching. He goes through several other teachers simultaneously. What progress he makes! How the rays of knowledge penetrate his awakening brain! The more exuberantly our speaker describes his evolution, the more ironic and bitterly human he sounds. With an effort which up till now has never been repeated, I managed to reach the cultural level of an average European. In itself, that might be nothing to speak of, but it is something insofar as it helped me out of my cage and opened a special way out for me, the way of humanity. There is an excellent idiom to fight one's way through the thick of things. That's what I have done. There was nothing else for me to do, provided always that freedom was not to be my choice. A pretty scathing indictment of the average European, wouldn't you say, who has obviously never reached anything like this ape's level of reasoning. More than in most animal satire, this ape works his way into our emotions, so that by the end we are neither merely amused nor amazed by him, but emotionally caught up in his predicament. Materially, he is doing very well by the end. He performs almost nightly with success that allows him evenings of wine and leisure. Lounging comfortably with his hands in his trouser pockets, he is a far cry from that earlier squatting beast in a cage. Instead of a keeper, he now has a manager. As he ends his report, all would seem to have ended well. He says, "When I come home late at night from banquets, from scientific receptions, from social gatherings, there sits waiting for me a half-trained little chimpanzee, and I take comfort from her, as apes do. By day I cannot bear to see her, for she has the insane look of the bewildered, half-broken animal in her eye. No one else sees it, but I do, and I cannot bear it. On the whole, at any rate, I have achieved what I set out to achieve, but do not tell me that it was not worth the trouble. In any case, I am not appealing for any man's verdict. I am only imparting knowledge. I am only making a report. To you also, honored members of the Academy, I have only made a report." So the ape now keeps a chimpanzee for his amusement, in the way his captors had once domesticated him. He is one step advanced over them in that he uses his half-broken animal with compassion. After all, he can sympathize with her predicament, as they never pitied him. The ape and Kafka, his author, write with an understanding gained by one who has experienced the process of being brought to heel. The ape sounds so human because of how much of himself Kafka has invested in this report. The more one knows about the author Franz Kafka from his writings, letters, diaries, and the enormous literature about him, the more of his personal physical agony we recognize in the narrator of this story. The cultural part is even more suggestive. Although the separation of the Jewish ghetto from the rest of Prague had ended before Kafka's birth in 1883, the Jews remained politically vulnerable between the Czech majority and the German-speaking elite. Adapting to German was the only way they could advance in Gentile society. Youngsters from relatively prosperous Jewish families, like Kafka's, were adjusting to a German-European civilization they knew was morally inferior to theirs, but which regarded itself as infinitely superior, and which demanded their accommodation as the price of their acceptance. So acculturate they did, and many of them became better at it, better at German, than the Germans. However, when Martin Buber spoke about Zionism to Kafka's circle, they responded passionately. They began to take their Judaism more seriously, and several eventually moved to Palestine. This parody was one of Kafka's several contributions to the literature of Zionism, since the first step toward national liberation was the realization that one had been functioning like an accommodating beast. Let's not interpret this too narrowly as a Jewish story, yet let's not miss how brilliantly it interprets the Jews. In fact, readers might have recognized themselves both in the ape and in his captors. At the same time the German-speaking Jews were forcibly adapting to German culture, many of them were also trying to civilize the Yiddish speakers who were now arriving from the East. Kafka identified strongly with that allegedly more primitive Yiddish culture, and he befriended actors of the Yiddish theater that he loved to attend. If the ape's career as a performer echoes Kafka's diary entries about his own becoming a German writer, the beast's compassion for his half-broken chimpanzee is very like the protective concern that Kafka expressed for Polish Jewry. Jewish assimilation is hardly the sole target of the ape's lecture. The Europeans who set out to educate this ape had no greater advantage over him than the power to shoot him in the wild and bring him back to Europe for their amusement. And what did they have to teach him in the first place? His captors know how to spit, smoke, and drink, and some of them experience freedom as control over their movements. Kafka makes a stronger case for the protection of animals than for the value of civilization. It is impossible to read this story without thinking of the slave ships that transported human beings in similar conditions, and of the colonizing projects by European nations that were then still in high gear. Or maybe the ape has come to think that the enslavement of others is just the way of the world. Those who experienced the rise of Nazism in Germany have always read Kafka as a prophet. And part of the ape's report prepares us for the cruelty of that historical development. Sigmund Freud, whose life, thought, and Jewish experience adjusting to German culture overlapped with Kafka's, also spoke eloquently about the sacrifices that civilization required. He wrote, "I will gladly renounce all the methods of satisfaction forbidden by society, but am I certain that society will reward this renunciation by offering me one of the permitted methods, even after a certain amount of postponement?" The permitted method he was thinking of was joking, making fun of things, which he welcomed because the wishes and desires of men have a right to make themselves acceptable alongside of exacting and ruthless morality. A report to an academy is a very serious form of joking about the sacrifices that civilization requires. Nazism enjoyed portraying the Jews as apes and showed them as hairy and ape-like in order to emphasize that they had not yet evolved into Aryans. Kafka had already revealed how much lower such people actually were in the evolution of the human species. So that's it for this very complex story. Until the next time, when we will be reading a poem by Avrohom Sutskever, I wish you happy reading.